A Syracuse music festival this weekend will be enriching to more than the audience that goes to hear former Nitty Gritty Dirt Band founder John McEwen and other acts. Aspiring youth musicians in the area will get a chance to learn about the music business from someone who's been in it for more than 50 years now. At WAR's Chris Bolt and Live Space Entertainment's Tom Honan spoke with McEwen and the festival creator Greg Hoover about the Sunrise Music and Youth Mentoring Festival.
So we have the Syracuse Sunrise Rotary Music Festival that's coming to town and that you're going to be part of. It's billed as a youth mentoring opportunity, and I wanted to ask what kind of mix of performance and youth involvement takes place at this event? And, you know, this is a question both for Greg and for John.
For me, it's a chance to meet some young artists that are trying to figure out the music business. And I can give them, I can tell them all kinds of mistakes I've made so they can avoid them and maybe give them some advice on how to proceed with their pursuit.
And Greg, go ahead and describe, you know, how do youth get involved and what's going to go on?
Well, as we organized this, I thought, what do young artists need? And they need to work on their art. But at the same time, there isn't one of us that can't remember a mentor that believed in us on the day we didn't believe in ourselves or we didn't know where to go next. And music is something that you have to network. And when you hear from artists that have been doing it for 10, 20, 30, 40 years internationally, it puts you 10 years ahead.
Well, and I would assume, John, that when a youth, if you talk to young musicians, I mean, these are people who are more serious about music than just somebody who plays in the school band or something. But when you do talk to somebody like that, and then they also are able to see a performance, it probably cements that even more so, makes it more real.
Yeah, that's one of the good things about it. You can bring them ideas of how to pursue their music. The music is one thing, but if they're going to get in the music business, they need to know what both words, how they work together. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that they maybe don't have an idea. You know, often people will write a song and they'll wonder, where do we take this? How do we do this? Or they don't know what to do after that. And I hope to give them some advice on that, as well as their music.
Greg, who's invited? Who are the kids who will show up to something like this? As I said, it's probably not the person who's in beginning band in fourth grade, right? These are people who have invested a little more.
They've invested a lot.
Right.
I'm surprised at their work. I'm going to ask them to teach me how to do it. Mm-hmm. 13, 14 years old. We have 16-year-old Kate Devon and Sarah Bullis, who's 14, and two Sammy Awards. Peyton Bird, Steven Serafin, L.J. Berger, a young great artist, guitar artist, Sydney Irving, who's organizing bands and little concerts herself, but she's 14 years old. Hmm. And it's 14 going on 34.
Right.
It's unbelievable the work they put in. And
so they're people with pretty big, their dreams are starting to take shape.
Yeah, and their parents are invested in this whole thing, too, and they're wondering what to do next, so they're seeing this opportunity as, and not only should we, it's like how can we and can we really soak it up here? Because they're going to be like sponges too. So it's a family thing, a family support thing. And, mm-hmm. and you can't beat music for something that can stay with them for the rest of their life.
Sure, right. Well, John, let's go backwards a little bit to when you got started in music. And, you know, did you have any mentors? Were there people there who allowed you to learn more or get a little bit more of a foothold? Can you remember any mentors back when you were getting started?
Well, musical mentors are one thing, and that would be Doug Dillard, who showed me how much fun it can be to play the banjo on stage and make it exciting for people that are watching, along with other blues musicians that I listened to and watched, and people like Earl Scruggs and various players. Those were the musical influences. But over the years, starting early in 1967, my first agent, I was talking to him about, what are we going to do? And I kept talking, and he said, John, you can't learn anything when you're talking. That was a big lesson. So it's good to hear other people's opinions about where to take things, because it is a commercial business where you're trying to sell something that you've made. And I try to relate that. Things like when a farmer plants a crop, he doesn't just harvest it and say, well, anybody want to buy this corn? No, he's already got the market ready and the distribution and the marketing of it and the shipment, because there's a very narrow window of when you can get something to the market. And those things are all important to have success in the music business and trying to figure out how you can make a living while you're playing. And that's all part of it. And I had several influences that showed me that path early on and much later on. I wish I had something like what's happening at the Sunrise Music Festival, just because there wasn't anything like that. You had to go look for it. Well, here's a place they could look for it, maybe get some good advice.
You know, John, having said that, it is interesting to me to look at the holistic landscape of the music industry. So you're right. You don't just write a song and you don't book the show and they will come. There's a whole lot of work to do, and a lot of it is based on professional and personal relationships. And, you know, going through your book, there's a lot of stories about those kinds of relationships and how they can help you, hurt you, they can go sour. And then the music industry changes, technology and stuff like that. Talk a little bit about that relationship-based approach to the music business and how you can stay in this for so long.
Well, you have to get to know people that are passionate about the side of promoting music or presenting concerts or making records, just as you have to get around people that are excited about making the music and contributing to it. And that is something that just takes a lot of time. I would say that it's safe to say for almost anyone that they'll spend. I would say the thing to try to point out is that a lot of the great people that we are familiar with and know maybe only spent 10% of their time playing music and crafting songs and writing them, and they spend the other 90% trying to get people to hear them and get the word out and get the word spread. That's where the hard part is. And the way I compare it to, some people ask, what's the difference between now and then? Well, back when I started, if you could picture a little baseball stadium with 10,000 people in the stands, and there's a guy with a guitar on home plate, and he starts playing, everybody's talking and eating hot dogs and stuff, and then pretty soon a couple start listening, and then there's a whole bunch listening, and then maybe everybody's listening to the guy on home plate, and they're liking him, and they're saying, hey, we want to hear another song. Well, that was then. Now you put the audience guy on home plate, and in the stands are 10,000 people with guitars and banjos all playing different songs. And it's impossible to figure out which one you want to listen to, so you go home.
Can you remember back to the start of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band? I mean, here's people coming together. It's not just you doing it, and now you have to work with people. How did that work in terms of who you knew or when it was able to get enough momentum to say, hey, we can actually do this?
Well, you need somebody that works in behalf of you when you're not able to do it, when you're traveling to go to a job, when you're rehearsing, when you're sleeping, whenever. You need other people that are telling the world about what you're doing. And I was very fortunate that my brother was managing the group, and he worked at that nonstop. He also managed Steve Martin and spent the same amount of time on him. And keep in mind that in those early days, you quite often will have people saying things like, this isn't going to work. I mean, for the Dirt Band, we were turned down by every record label in L.A. twice. And finally, one of them said on the third try, well, maybe we should record that song. It might be a hit. And that was Buy For Me the Rain, our first radio record. Steve Martin was turned down by every record label in L.A., same manner. And finally, my brother got him a deal at Warner Brothers. And his reviews in the LA Times were things like, this comedian should be funny. He's not. Or somebody should tell the opening act, Steve Martin, that jokes are supposed to have punchlines. And
it's a process.
Our first review of the LA Times said, very entertaining young new group. Doubtful if they'll ever be captured on record. Try to get a record deal with that.
Yeah, no kidding. Wow.
So, John,
but
with
you have to stem the tide and get past that and keep in mind things like Well, when Jack London wrote Call of the Wild, he was turned down over 600 times by publishers till he finally got published.
Wow.
And it's not a new thing. The uphill climb for the overnight success takes years.
Yeah, and that's going to be one of the big lessons for the folks at the festival. Now, taking a step further, you get the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band started. Then a particular song comes along. Jerry Jeff Walker writes this song. How did that come to you guys, and then how did that become the hit that it did? Explain all the process of getting that song, recording it, and then promoting it, and how it just took off like that.
Well, we were making our fifth album, and we decided that it needed to be a broader range of music, better played than what we've been doing, and we got to get to radio somehow. And we put a bunch of songs on there. They weren't all our own by any means. There were some original pieces of music, but there was one by Mike Nesmith called Some of Shelley's Blues, and Kenny Loggins was a new young songwriter. It would have fit right into this festival. He was 19 or 18, and he brought us a bunch of songs, but how did he bring them to us? He was hanging out at the club every night that we were playing and saying, hey, you guys ought to do some of my songs. So he was very passionate and energetic about his own music, and I recorded a demo on him. And we ended up, he recorded 7 songs. We did 4 of them. So that got some of his music on that album. And then we were rehearsing, and Jeff Hanna had said, I heard a song on the radio last night on the way home from rehearsal that sounded perfect for me. And I tell this whole story in complete detail at the concert as part of the show because it's an interesting aspect of how music comes about. And we learned it off Jerry Jeff Walker's demo and recorded it on the Uncle Charlie album, and we thought it was just a good album cut. It wasn't destined for top 40 radio. And for our 3rd single, the company said, we're putting out Mr. Bojangles. We thought our career was over. A song in 3/4 time about a dancer with a dead dog? That'll never make it.
That'll work.
And, and it just took off. Very slowly took off, but it ended up being on the charts for 36 weeks, more than half a year. And it helped establish the career in 1970 for the Dirt Band. And it was just a strange thing. It happens all the time where a songwriter doesn't, or a group will not think that a piece of their music is the strongest one. And that's a magic thing. People can influence that decision. There's a famous story about a band that was making an album, a rock band from Kansas, that was, they needed one more song for their record. And one of the guys said, well, how about that thing that we always warm up with before we go out and play? We just do it with the acoustic guitar. And, what's that one called? Oh, Dust in the Wind.
Yeah, right.
So the group,
I've heard
the group
that story
Kansas
before, yeah.
Threw Dust in the Wind on their album, and that was it. That was their career record that helped get them started. So the point of that lesson is listen to other people, make your own decisions, and pursue what you're passionate about. And if along the way people aren't really liking what you do, well, then they're not the ones that are going to like you, but you're going to find people who do.
Yeah, and John, those years of toiling away and being the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band and such, you had the opportunity to work with so many different kinds of artists, different bands, different sounds, and stuff that might not look like a perfect co-bill or an opening act. Are there some acts that you may have opened for or worked with that you were surprised to be there? And how did it work? And what were some of those experiences like?
Well, when you have a record on the radio and you have an agency that's booking you, they'll have other acts. And so sometimes you end up being booked on a show with one of the agency's other acts. In our case, it would be people from as broad a spectrum as Bobby Sherman, Jolie, 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 do you love me, to the Doors. And trying to figure out how to go over to that audience was quite a challenge. And it usually worked. And you end up on shows doing what you do. And it's hard to explain, Tom, but you just go out and take everything. I can't tell you the number of free shows that both I and the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band have done over the years because of that phrase that's in the music business, it's good exposure. Well, if it's good exposure, go get it, you know. And you might end up playing on a flatbed truck in the middle of a field for a crowd that doesn't know what you do, and then some of them will like you, but you did a good thing, and you made more money a night before than you did that day. But it's not always the money. It's exposure and believing in what you do. And whatever act you end up on a show with, it's your show when you're on stage. So make it as good as you can.
Now, you certainly have played a lot of music away from and after the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. What kind of music have you played since? What do you really enjoy doing musically, you know, say in the last couple of decades intervening and up to now?
Well, what I bring to the stage, like in Syracuse, is some of my favorite Nitty Gritty Dirt Band songs, many of which haven't been on the Dirt Band stage for 30 or 40 years, from the earlier recordings. And then some music from the album, Will the Circle Be Unbroken? Are you familiar with that album?
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Now, here's a case where I didn't know what would happen. I just knew I wanted to record with Earl Scruggs. So one night I asked him, after I'd gotten to meet him 6 months earlier, and we became friends, and I asked him if he'd record with Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, and he said, I'd be proud to. And a week later, Doc Watson was playing the same club in Colorado. And I asked him the same question, and he jumped on board. And my brother, who is managing the group and producing the records, said, I'm going to get Merle Travis. And we asked Earl if he could get Maybelle Carter. Long story short, that album, Will the Circle Be Unbroken, well, it's ended up in the Library of Congress and the Grammy Hall of Fame, and we had no idea it would go that far. And even today, it's on the Amazon Bluegrass chart somewhere between number 7 and 40 every week. It drifts around. I look at it every now and then. And, oh, it's 32 this week. Oh, it's 15 this week.
With that kind of a mindset, when you produce albums and you work with other artists, Steve Martin among them, and now you're a teacher. Now they're looking to you for what you would bring to the table to make perhaps a unique sound with an artist using a song that maybe they weren't familiar with or they really wanted to do. What is that experience like, being a teacher, being the producer in the studio?
Well, one of the things about telling people about their pursuit and how to make it easier is maybe giving them a lot of things that they can leave out, that they can do better from the beginning or from the just getting going. It's a long list of little things. For instance, make sure your fricatives are heard on the recording. That means that all the sounds in a song, like it's home on the range, not home on the rain.
Mm-hmm.
It's love. When Elvis sings, "You ain't nothing but a hound dog," he does say dogga, D-O-G-U, because that's the way you understand it on a record. He doesn't go, "You ain't nothing but a hound dog, dog." He goes dogga. And you don't think of that when you hear it, but you know what the word is. So you have a couple of things you have to do with your original music. Get the lyric across, and then put some chords behind it and a little rhythm, and get the melody across. So you start with the melody and the lyric. You have to hear every word. And if the mix is such that you can't understand all the words, then your words must not mean that much. No, but they do. So make sure you don't put everybody playing the same note. You don't want the piano and the guitars and the mandolin and the bass playing up high. You don't want everybody in the middle of the keyboard on the piano, if that's where the singing is being done. There's only so many people that can occupy 880 cycles, which is like an A note above middle C. And if there's too many people on that frequency, it's going to be hard to turn the vocal up if that's the note they're hitting. So spread your arrangement out. It's things like that. And the thing I like to do is ask these younger people, what are your questions? What do you want to do? And that will often lead you to some aspect of something you've learned.
Well, I was going to say that the producer role ties right into where we started this conversation, which is, you know, how do you relate this stuff to young people about whether it's just as you described there, you know, kind of arranging a song or practice or preparing for a gig? I mean, it seems like some of the producer skills just roll right over into this kind of teaching mission with some of these aspiring artists.
It's all part of it. And again, I relate to the farmer. His tractor has to work. He has to have a place to store stuff that is not going to get ruined. He has to have the market ready. He has to know what to make things, how to make things grow, and when to plant them. Well, when you're doing the music, you have to be able to get the lyric out there and make sure it's understood and make sure the music is recorded as best you can and that the energy is there. I'm a big fan of being able to do something with the first take. You know, you don't get on the airplane and the pilot says, yeah, we'll be heading to Pittsburgh in about 5 minutes. Oh, no, we're going to Philadelphia in a few minutes. Sorry about that. You know, you don't hear the pilot say, we'll be taking off in about 10 minutes. Oh, no, here we go. You know. They're prepared.
They don't want to practice first.
The dentist doesn't say, well, what tooth are we going? Oh, geez, I drilled on number 7. It was supposed to be 27. You know, you go in and it's a profession that you have to treat as a profession.
Greg,
and be ready.
Greg, in this kind of environment, since you're really close to the kids, what do you hope they get out? You know, they're not going to take everything away, but what are some of the things that you would say are the most important things for them to get out of the opportunity to be with a lifelong musician with all these experiences?
Well, fortunately, this will be our fourth Syracuse Sunrise Rotary. It's a fundraiser. Mm-hmm. And we thought, well, let's have some fun doing a fundraiser. And what could be more fun than music, which
right.
I do too. And John, thank you for joining us on this. And John said something that virtually every one of my New York City or Nashville or Platinum Gold Record songwriters in previous years has said, I wish somebody had done this for me.
Yeah.
And John gets it.
Yeah.
It's not hard to get. The real guys get it. And to bring your experience and your expertise here, I get to see what they get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And John's already going to know because he's probably done this throughout the years for other kids. But at the same time, it's a really, really cool thing to see. Mm-hmm. And you can't replace it. We all remember our mentors. And John, you get a chance to be in the memory of some kids for the rest of their life because we all never forget our mentors.
This is an interesting comment because you never know who you're affecting.
You don't.
I was watching the great guitar player Steve Vai one night at a club in L.A., and a guy standing next to me is about 20 years younger maybe, and he said, I just got to tell you, you've been a big influence on my life, and I've always thought of you, and I work with and try to, it was very complimentary. And he told me his name, and I stood there thinking for a minute. I go, excuse me, did you say your name was Steve Lukather? He goes, yeah, that's it. He goes, well, don't you play, like, lead guitar in Toto? He goes, yeah, that's me.
Yeah, right.
I said, well, how could I play the banjo. I think you got the wrong guy. He goes, no, I know exactly who you are. You may not remember, but when I was in sixth grade, I'd been playing the guitar for a few years and thought it was kind of boring. And you came to my class and played for an hour, and it was so much fun and so exciting. And you showed us how the instruments worked and in different ways. And I went home and started practicing and wanted to be like you.
Wow, that's great. I mean, in either of your cases, you know, these kids are, again, they're more interested in this than the average band member.
That's great.
Do you find that there are also kids that maybe they don't listen, or are they pretty enraptured? Are they, go ahead, Greg, are they pretty ready to seize this opportunity?
I'm amazed at the dedication of these kids. Like I said, I think John's going to learn something from them. Social media, how to do it, or something. I mean, every time, I know John is hooked up with rookies, and every time you learn back and forth in music. And and you'll come away with John, you'll come away with an experience, and it'll all be valuable. And most of these kids are songwriters, and you'll see the emergence of something that that could be quite good in what they do. And the early concert from 2 o'clock on is going to knock people's socks off. It's be a very, very big surprise. And it's going to lead into, fortunately, the great concert with Lauren Berger and a little opening, and then your band introducing so many of the songs that I know these kids are going to like, but, you know, with all the flood of music, we don't always get to hear. So it's going to be a great, great gem to put that all together.
Yeah, and John, one other example I wanted to touch on about teaching, and you might remember a couple of years ago, you and I did this program down at Bethel Woods where it was titled Teaching Teachers the 60s. And so there were
yeah.
So you got to play Woodstock there. And the group of teachers were in their 30s and 40s perhaps and were knowledgeable about that era, but not maybe by firsthand knowledge, maybe by friends or relatives or parents or even grandparents. And I remember your presentation, and one thing in particular was offering a perspective on freedom. And you mentioned about touring Russia and compared it to the Woodstock concert, that sort of thing. Can you just touch upon that perspective of a worldly view of freedom, some notions that people might not have been thinking of?
Well, you know, you can do anything you want if you're living in America. You can try to do anything you aspire to. And most often, the things that hold people back are what people say to them and them taking that negative, who do you think you are? You shouldn't be doing that. Or what makes you think you can have a hit record? Or that song isn't so good. Or you shouldn't, and that's already been invented. Things like that. People are prone to put down things they don't understand. If you're doing something new, it's a good chance that other people don't understand it yet, but it might catch on. A case in point was when a famous story of Alice Cooper's manager-to-be was watching Alice playing a show. Alice Cooper went on, there's 1,000 people in the room, and by the end of the set, there was only 200 left. He said, I knew I had something. 800 people walk out. And 200 stay. You know there's something there, you know. And the freedom aspect is keep doing it if you believe in it. Follow input that you get. Not follow, but listen. And maybe you'll learn something from it. Not that you'll alter what you're doing, but you might. You might find out that saying certain things are not as good as saying others. There's times when the dirt band would spend hours working up a song, and we go out and play it, it wouldn't go over. So we drop it. Why should we play a song that doesn't go over? Those are in the early years. But as far as freedom goes, if you take songs and use the number system, like 1-4-5, that means the one chord would be C, the four chord would be F, the five chord would be G, and you write a chord chart based upon the scales. This song goes 1-4-1-5, 1-5-1-4. And you write a chart like that, and you play along with it. I was describing that to several different times, but one time in particular in Russia, where I said, and so the musicians will write down the chords of the song they're going to record, and it might be 1-4-4-5, and then 5-5-4-1. And then I gave them a longer list of numbers, and then I played to it. And translating's going on, and the question comes up, well, what do the musicians play to the chords? They don't just strum the chords. No, they play along with the chords. Well, what notes do they play? And I says, well, they play along with the chords of the song and listen to the singer. Well, what do they play? What notes? When I said they play what they feel like playing that fits the lyric. And the chatter went around the room, and that got a standing ovation.
Hmm.
We can't do that here.
Yeah, right.
We only get to play what is on the paper.
Uh-huh.
You know, such freedom. You often refer, when I talk to younger people that are doing anything musically or whatever, I don't refer to them as kids because I try to make the point, okay, how many people like Frankenstein, the story? Well, that was written by a 15-year-old Mary Shelley. And you've heard of Mozart, right? Yeah, he conducted at 8 years old. You know who Mark O'Connor is? He's winning fiddle contests at 14, playing like he was 40. That there's something magical that goes on for younger people that get in tune to music. I had a 12-year-old fiddle player sit in with me last month. The guy blew the roof away. He was like Vassar Clements at 12. He wasn't a 12-year-old kid. He happened to be 12.
Right.
Might take your job away. Him, be careful.
Darn him. Yeah. He was absolutely cool. We played the Sheik of Araby. We rehearsed it like a half of a time. And I said, okay, you'll get it. And we go out on stage, we're playing this old jazz song. And on the second solo, I yelled at him, I'll play like Stephen Grappelli. And he did.
Oh, wow. Well, John, we're very excited to have you come to Syracuse for the Syracuse Sunrise Rotary Music Festival. Your book is The Life I've Picked. And thanks for talking with us here on WAER today.
Well, thank you. People are going to really enjoy their day if they spend it at the Palace Theater.
That's right. All right. Take care.
Thank you, John. We'll talk later.
Okay.